the creator economy is this sort of ride you get on and you never know how you're going to get off it.
Well, and there's the pressure when you have a book coming out of like, you need to be on all the platforms. You need to be marketing yourself. Like, that's how the book industry works now. There's rigor at every level.
A lot of control has been given up in order to secure the bag.
You write so much about like questioning these things and the questioning power, et cetera.
I want to break academic food studies out of its kind of ivory tower.
Again, you're not a creator, you're a writer.
Yeah, exactly.
Major milestone, major change. What's going on?
So here, this is an exclusive from me.
A scoop. Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. If this is your first time listening, my name is Francis Zier, and besides hosting this podcast, I run a newsletter by the same name. And in both, each week, I interview and profile a different person working in the creator economy to learn how they approach the production and business of digital media, of content. By the way, if this is your first time listening, I would love it if you subscribed. Today, we are speaking with Alicia Kennedy, who is an essayist and culture critic best known for her newsletter, From the Desk of Alicia Kennedy, which has over 40,000 subscribers and has been running for 5 years. She is easily one of the best writers we've had on the show, and I don't think I would call her a creator because she specifically has said she doesn't want to be called that and has really built a career as a writer. Writing is her work. And while she's primarily a food writer, she's razor sharp on plenty of other topics, and much of what I wanted to speak with her about comes from a handful of essays she's written about writing, the algorithm, and the politics of attention, basically all the things that compose being a creator. Here's the episode. This was a great conversation. Enjoy. I think there is only one way to start this conversation, and that is by quoting one of your essays at length, which is your September 2022 essay on selling a lifestyle. So a couple paragraphs I'll read here. Something is happening to the food writers. We're losing our minds. This job requires knowledge of not just food and cooking, plus whatever one's niche is that makes them desirable on the market, but also to be a photographer, not new, and now a videographer, perhaps with three cameras in various positions in order to ensure a cinematic result when we go on to act as editors. Oh, and we should maybe know how to host a podcast and edit audio for good measure. We are food stylists and recipe developers and restaurant recommenders. We are everything because there's no other choice. Being a freelancer means you're also an entrepreneur, which means you're every department of your company, says Abigail Koffler, whose newsletter This Needs Hot Sauce comes out biweekly. I am loath to think of myself as an entrepreneur, yet here I am. So I felt like there's no other way to start this conversation because this is you rejecting the conditions of being a creator. And actually in the comments to that piece, you reply to a reader and you say, well, I hope I don't come off as a content creator. I just want to be a writer. And I have to say you do come off as a writer and like a serious writer and not a content creator. And I think obviously there's a lot to unpack there. So I would love if you could speak to kind of how you define the creator label and why and how you reject it.
So 2022 was a very different time than 2025, let's say. And so true. I think that because of the time in which I wrote that piece, which was like only vaguely post-pandemic, only sort of TikTok was in its ascendancy in a real way, I think, where I had not rejected TikTok, but I was like, oh, that's just not for me. I'm not a video person.
Not going to get on that train.
I don't need to get on that train. Like, I'm trying to have some restraint with social media. I have never exercised restraint around social media in my entire life. So like, let's start now. But then I had to get on it because of an assignment to write about recipe development as a job. And honestly, like, I have enjoyed for the most part and have a decent relationship with watching TikToks. It's not something that, you know, I have a compulsion with, but it did really bring into focus for me what I was writing about in that piece, which was, you know, the idea that you just have no escape and no break and you have to keep learning and being agile and you have to have a good attitude about it. You have to put a good face on. So when you take on the label of creator, you're more saying that you're making content, obviously. Yeah. And that content is being shared and owned by like these platforms where you have no control over anything. And 2022, I think, was also, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that was the year that Instagram changed its algorithm a lot. And so I think I was maybe
like when they introduced Reels. probably.
It might have been that. And then there was a piece in the New York Times about small business owners having a lot of trouble. And it might have been around that time too. So these were all these things kind of coming into like this what felt like a swamp of content that you couldn't control. You can't control the algorithms. You're like, I had a really like Instagram was always fine for me until this shift that happened where I felt like I wasn't really able to share my work. And I was like kind of scrambling to be like, how do I change myself? How do I like make little reels about, you know, making ice pops or whatever it is like to entertain this like beast of a machine? And why do I have to do this? Like, why are the conditions of my job such that I have to not just be a good writer at the top of my game, writing a newsletter, writing for out publications, writing a book? At that time, I was waiting for my first book to come out. I was doing edits. And then also, and like, I take pictures because I like to take pictures, not because of any sort of
machine. Not because Instagram forced you to learn.
Not because Instagram didn't force me. Like, that was me my whole life. But learning video or trying to figure out what my vibe was on video was just a whole other thing that I never wanted to do. And, you know, it just felt like this swarm of things, and it just felt really confusing. And so I wrote that piece as a way to try and navigate my way through what I was feeling, which was just overwhelm. And also I wrote that piece, and I think it has that sort of a tone of just like kind of desperation and rage, because I was like, I knew I had to maintain everything I was doing, and I had to maintain a level of attention for the release of my first book so that it would come out and be successful. And so like trying to tread water, I always characterize it as like those couple of years of my life. When my newsletter started, I wrote a book, and then I was waiting for the first book to come out. It was like treading water of trying to be like, I can't do anything to lose.
Well, and there's the pressure when you have a book coming out of like, you need to be on all the platforms. You need to be marketing yourself. Like that's how the book industry works now.
Exactly.
I think, something that just occurred to me while you were saying that is like how you know, photography was something you were always interested in and doing anyways, but video was like a bridge too far. I'm thinking of I don't know if kerfuffle is the right word, a little Substack notes thing this morning where you posted a note seeing someone on here confuse citation for plagiarism isn't giving me a lot of hope for media literacy.
Yes.
But I also know so many people have zero clue on journalistic norms or ethics and no one around to ask. Then like I also read before I read that this morning, I saw that somebody reposted this on Twitter, an article in Pointer called "I'm a Gen Z Journalist. My Generation Doesn't Know What That Means."
Yeah.
Kind of a whole different thing that both that your kind of conversation on Substack notes and that get into. But long way of saying, it occurs to me that like the media literacy maybe now is like analytically and like understanding ideology behind a given thing is lower than ever. But like literacy around producing the media product is higher than ever. And so a 23-year-old will know how to produce like amazing TikTok videos, but they might not know what ideology they're reproducing when they make the video.
Yes. That's really interesting. I think that's really interesting. And I think that I liked that piece. I read that piece when it came out. I think I'm a Gen Z journalist and my generation doesn't know what that means. And it's really difficult to navigate against because, and again, it comes with this feeling of swampiness in terms of like platforms and content and like everyone is in the same sea, so to speak, but doing very different things and coming to it with very different backgrounds and very different literacies, various literacies. And so, you know, for me, I see someone young and confused about what it means to be quoted in the New York Times. And I'm just like,
awesome that you're being quoted.
It's so awesome that you're being quoted. And if I was young and was being quoted there, I would have been losing my mind. Like,
we should say for the listener who hasn't read this thing that, it's this young writer who had written this essay on their Substack, and who, by the way, this is a whole nother thing, is very much talking about their writing as a Substack using the initials SS for it too, which is crazy.
Ooh, that's crazy because of the times we live in.
The
times we live in. And I'm like, you're calling it SS all the time.
It's an ideological nacho. I think, okay, where I was going with this though is, yeah, she's been quoted and by name with a backlink to her site, to her newsletter. And even like there was like an Instagram carousel quoting her by name, and she was pissed about it because she's like, why am I not compensated for this? Which is like almost gets into then like this like NFT concept of ownership and like artist royalties and such. Okay, a lot there. But that's what this was to the listener who didn't know. I think, okay, one last thing on media literacy before we move on. is, again, when I read your note there, I was thinking how something I think about a lot, decreased media literacy, I think, is a desirable outcome for, let's say, this administration that has recently begun, and certainly the billionaire class, right? Because it's you then who's loudest. I mean, this is, I almost feel like this is like so simple, like dorm room philosophizing, but like then who's loudest can like define the meaning. Where I'll end this is a shoddy tweet, but I crystallized yesterday, is like the three tenets of our cultural moment are a decrease in friction, which is like crypto, Zen, and basically every app, sports gambling apps especially. Mm-hmm. Entrepreneurialism being the creator economy, the gig economy, and then decentralization of meaning being like Facebook removing fact checkers for community notes and Elon Musk's Doge department. And all these things I think are actually the same thing, but I couldn't think of the perfect word to tie them together.
Well, I think that removing friction is something that I've been talking about this a lot, because I think the notion of friction is one that we are losing completely, but also in discourse, where people don't like to have a conversation that is uncomfortable. Or like and in a way that, not that you have to have a conversation with Nazis, certainly not, just to go back to the SS thing, which is like really blowing my mind. But the fact of, you know, how it's very, very difficult. And I think it speaks to maybe a generational difference that there's some emotional reaction to disagreement that I think people have when they're very online. And when their political beliefs have been formed and fomented online, there's this kind of emotional response, you know, and like, it's like, well, I watched a TikTok that said, for example, Frida Kahlo is bad. And so if you are bringing up Frida Kahlo, I'm going to have this big emotional reaction about it. Yeah. And so, and that's part, like that's the intellectual component of these losses of friction in terms of our other engagements, whether it's with money, whether it's with other people, you know, the loss even of, like entrepreneurialism is like, you lose the whole notion of having a coworker and having to debate and go, you know, so there's just this constant, like just desire for ease and affirmation that comes with that too, that is an intellectual problem.
Hey, if you're enjoying this episode, make sure you subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss next week's episode. We release a new one every Thursday. Enjoy. Okay, let's talk about public intellectualism.
Okay.
I'm again going to quote you a little bit. So in your May 2023 essay on myself, you write that the essays get called on X in what was intended to be a humorous, knowing nod to public intellectuals past. And then this morning, too, on subsegment notes, you wrote, but this is another reason why the independent writers versus mainstream media narrative is bad. Do you want to be a public intellectual or do you want to wear a tin hat? So I wanted to ask precisely what you meant by that, by what's the difference between being a public intellectual and wearing a tin hat?
Well, I was just kind of making a joke about how a lot of people on Substack are really obsessed with Substack as Substack, and they're really obsessed with the idea that they're like these renegades against the mainstream media and that sort of thing. They don't see themselves as journalists doing a job the same way that a writer doing an opinion column or doing reporting at the New York Times or whatever is doing a job. And so they have in a lot of the responses to the note we were discussing before, I saw someone saying something like, I used to blog and the Atlantic stole my ideas all the time. And to me, that sounds like a conspiracy theorist with a tin hat. And so,
understand the public sphere and like the idea that you're always standing on other people's ideas. And it's this,
And we're all grasping at ideas that are in the ether. We're all in this world reading things. You know, it's not, nothing is the most original idea or thought ever. And so, and then I always say public intellectual with kind of a smirk and as a joke, which is why it was funny when I saw it in your notes, because I was like, oh, I don't actually seriously consider myself a public intellectual.
I took it directly from you. Actually, I have to say, I mean, the on X thing, when I was reading a lot of your works, like I loved it as somebody like who one of my most influential classes in college was, I took a class called Montaigne and the Life of the Essay, and all his essays are on blank, right? So like to me, that's like my purest form of the essay that I love to read. So I was like, I mean, just by adopt, it's kind of like how you reject the creator label and call yourself a writer, and like you do that by just saying that constantly.
Yes.
And by saying, I don't know, by saying like on blank, you're framing it. There's like no irony. It is a public intellectual essay.
It is because in the ways in which, I make this joke about it because it's such a silly thing. In the US, we like don't have public intellectuals. Like we're not, you know, maybe the closest in recent memory would have been Christopher Hitchens, who was British. Like no one is taken seriously who is, you know, in that sphere. Like,
there are these public intellectuals, but they're fragmented, right? Like you might have like a Paul Graham, who's another British guy, but who's like a tech world public intellectual who so many people look to for ideas in his like 800 word essays, right? Like Founder Mode was such an influential recent one. So like, I think there are these, and then there's like more like leftist type people who are against this thing. But I guess the public aspect implies there being like a larger reach, maybe across ideological borders.
Yeah, like Foucault on TV in France or something. Yeah, true. Like we don't really have that equivalent. And so, you know, I just think that it's funny because the U.S. is like kind of anti-intellectual for the most part. And that's fine. I mean, it's not fine, but it like I'm not trying to fight against that. Yeah. It's the world we live in. And so for me, I think just claiming, like making this kind of silly claim to it, or making this silly claim to like the on X construction, was just a way of like, one, I'm really bad at titling things. And that's why my newsletter is called From the Desk of Alicia Kennedy. Like I have like one good headline a year in me, and I do not waste it on my own newsletter. Like
on I'll myself put it, is a great headline.
It's so and like these things are meant to be tongue in cheek to me. Like if you knew me, and like, cause I do think it's a very different experience to like read me versus to actually talk to me, because I've gotten very much better, but like if you don't understand like my humor and the tonality of what I'm trying to say, then it will come across as a little bit of like, you know,
self-serious.
Yeah.
I don't think so though, reading it. I don't know, but maybe I'm just like, I did like, you know, read your writing for like 3 hours straight last night. So it's like, and in very good faith, right? So maybe that's why.
Yeah, good faith is always hard to come by.
Okay, another thing I want to quote from the On Myself essay. You write, "I consider my main career accomplishment to be having been a contributing writer at the Village Voice. My name is on the masthead of the last official paper. This probably tells you a lot about what I value in my work. Independence, a strong point of view, humor, rigor, and a reverence towards power," which I thought was very like clear-eyed, a very clear-eyed definition of yourself, and definitely comes across in how I read you too. And I think I would also add to that like a value for community, for discussion, for being a contributor to society in kind of the way we were talking about like 5 minutes ago. And maybe you want to speak more to that too, but I was also curious because I'm like, oh, was your biggest accomplishment not like publishing your first book, right? So I'm like, what could surpass that?
Well, for me, the funny thing is that that was all I had in mind for myself, frankly. Like growing up, I was like, I want to work in magazines. I want to write. And for me, the Village Voice, more than the New York Times or the New Yorker even, or anywhere else, was the place I wanted to be because it was the place that was the coolest, frankly. Like, so I just got an email one day in, I think, 2016, that was food writing at the Village Voice ? And I was like, oh, I did it. Like, that was it. Like, check. Like I accomplished what I wanted to do because I wanted to be seen by people who would have been at this kind of storied alternative weekly. And so, you know, and especially, you know, having grown up on Long Island, and like the city was always this like place that was at once like the
big and far
most
away,
important place. In reach, but far away. And so I always, you know, that it, just to be kind of accepted in that way was really significant for me. And so, you know, publishing a book, and now, you know, I have a second book that'll come out next year. These are great, but I have this kind of mindfulness thing where I try not to attach too much value to what these things do or are.
That's healthy. I think too, it is part of the like being part of something rather than like it would almost be uncharacteristically solipsistic for you to say that, right? You're publishing your book was the big accomplishment. Okay, let's talk about the money of it all, making a living. So you, I think, have been making a living solely through your writing for most of the last decade, I think.
10 years.
For fully 10 years, you've been making a living fully independently as a writer.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, sometimes I'd have to copy edit or do stuff, but
yeah, but that's not as a full-time employee. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So in your 2024 essay, Algorithm of the Mind, you write, I've said this before a few different ways, and I think it bears repeating and re-interrogating. I have this newsletter, but I'm not really better off materially than I was years ago as a regular contributor to papers and magazines, even if I have more freedom and I'm doing better work. This is the creator economy trade-off. Predictable instability for unpredictable instability. I criticize corporate soft power and the fracturing of the media landscape because I'm in the strange position of being both its beneficiary and its victim, because I watch so many people day after day seem to accept that this is it, that this is just how we do things now. So maybe there's something else in there you also want to speak to, but what the question I have is, like, how would you judge your material reality now compared to, like, the tail end of your, I think it was 6 years as a copy editor at New York Mag?
Well, the thing is, the whole economy is different. And that's part of why
the creator economy didn't really exist 10 years ago.
Well, yeah, the creator economy didn't exist, but also money went farther. Like, you know, so I've always felt like once I'm making more money, like, the rug gets pulled out from under me and everything costs more, which is not a unique position to be in. And especially because I've chosen this kind of, you know, strange and non-lucrative career of being a writer. You know, when I was at New York Magazine, things were very different. Like, my rent in Bushwick when I quit there was $800 a month. You know, it was a different time. I was making like $53,000 a year. At the end, I started there in 2010 at like 45K. So it's not like I got one nice bump and then
in
it
six
was
years.
In 6 years. Yeah. And so, you know, when I left there, it was because my freelance food writing started to do pretty well. I went to Food and Wine on a temporary freelance contract for a little while and was also, you know, contributing to magazines and stuff. Basically, I wrote that piece at a particularly bad time because I had taken the first half of the year to write my next book.
Okay.
And so I wasn't focusing as much energy on my newsletter. So I wasn't focusing as much energy on generating, like, converting people, you know, et cetera. Like, which
all
is
these
that
marketing
that
terms.
Yeah, but also that's a religious term, and so it's that's not true. Lost on me always, like, the conversion aspect of it.
That's a really interesting point.
Yeah. And so I had spent the first half of the year doing this. Then I had gotten news that our landlords were selling our apartment here in San Juan, Puerto Rico, because I've been living in San Juan. And so it was a bad time in terms of, like, I was like, this just isn't working the way my life used to work. Like, and I'm even talking about, like, 2020, 2021, which was when I still had, on top of the newsletter and on top of writing my first book, I still had lots of publications to write for.
Yeah.
So I was never feeling the pressure of, this newsletter is my only, like, work lifeline. And I had really consciously tried to avoid that happening. Like, I put a lot of work into my newsletter. I love doing it. It's my favorite thing. It's the best job I could have. But at the same time, I'm constantly, like, my weekly income depends on how much people, like me this week.
Yeah.
And I can't, like, that's really stressful. And it really does put a strain on one's mental health. And the fact that, like, I, at the end of 2023, felt really comfortable and really in a good place and was like, okay, I'm going to take, you know, at least the first 6 months of 2024 to kind of pull back a little bit on the newsletter. I'm going to write 2 new essays a month. And I did all these new features things to, like, try to make it work. But then it just, like, kind of, like, not that my income fell flat. The readership didn't fall flat. Like, the views didn't fall flat. I, you know, it wasn't like I was losing free subscribers, but the conversions were lower, and it was because I was putting less into it. And I knew that and I felt it. And I also had taken that time off from posting a lot on Instagram. Like, I had taken that time off. I really wanted to write I wanted my second book to
Were you off Twitter yet?
Good. Oh yeah. I'd been off Twitter since 2022. So like, but like I, you know, I had taken this time to, like, really try to do a good job with a book. And I was like, wow. Like, you just get no break. And then I realized after, and I've talked about this with other folks who have independent newsletters, like, last August, I took time off and I told readers I was taking time off. I came back and, like, September, I dropped, like, 40 paid subscribers.
Okay, wait, I have to talk about your paid subscribers, because I signed up for 1 month to read your archive. And it's $10 per month. And I've never seen this before. It's $30 per year, 75% off, which I thought was amazing. If I, you know, I have to be honest, I'm not going to subscribe for a year. This is my big thing is I interview so many people with paid newsletters. I'm like, I'm sorry, I can't subscribe for the full year. But if I was like just a reader coming and discovering it and being like, this is cool writing, I've discovered organically and I want to subscribe. There's no way I would buy the monthly. I would buy the yearly. $30. Yeah. Like, it's insane to not buy the yearly. Was it always like that? Or did you put that to drive conversion?
I did it. Well, I did it because this year I'm paywalling more. I'm paywalling like everything. And
so I'll get into that too.
So I've always had it at $30 because I think as an independent writer, I don't want the barrier to people like resubscribing to be so high that they feel like, oh, I can't support this person. Cause like $50, even to me, to give to like one person is like, it's a lot. Like I just feel like it's too much, frankly. Like, and for me, $30, it's, you know, it's
$30 is the price of a new hardcover. Yeah.
A new hardcover. Yeah. And so that's the basis of it. Basically, it's like, if you can spend 1 year with me, you get basically a book's worth of work. And also on top of that, now I have like a lot more community aspects of it, which we can talk about. But the reason I did the $10 monthly was because I was just like, you know what, fuck it. Like, if people want to just dip in and dip out, that's cool. But I want to make a little bit more money off of that. Like, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Like, I'm like, it's really not like a big, I'm not trying to convince people to do annual if they don't want to do annual. Because the annual really is for people who, like, they want to have, you know, chat conversations. They want to come to... Yeah, they want to be in the salons. Again, me picking like grandiose names for things as kind of a joke because I am like who I am. And then like, you know, and want to do the book club and that's kind of stuff. They want like, you know, the little more social community elements of joining up. They're going to pay the $30. But people who just want to dip in and read something or they're curious about something, I just want to get like whatever after the Substack and the Stripe fee, more than $5 from that.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. So you are going to be paywalling pretty much everything. As you've said, in March. Yeah. So this will come out like a week before March. So you'll be about to do it. and it's also marks your 5 years writing the newsletter, I believe.
Yeah.
Major milestone, major change. What's going on?
I mean, the thing is, last fall I had like my viewership was crazy. Like, it was just so high in terms of like my actual list. And like,
do you think was it like some essay you wrote that was just wildly popular and shared?
My stuff doesn't go viral. Like, I am not a virality writer. Like, but I do have very, very consistent readership. And so, but I wrote a piece like on Martha Stewart, on the Martha Stewart documentary, that did really well. You know, a few essays, you know, everything was just doing really, really well. But financially, I felt like I wasn't being compensated enough. And so, you know, obviously, with the number of paid subscribers that I have, if I were charging everyone $50 a month, I would be like the newsletter itself would be a six-figure newsletter.
Yeah.
But like, I don't, because I have this kind of, you know, desire to not be a burden on people.
You also might lose some subscribers. Yeah,
exactly. I would lose people, and people wouldn't. You know, I did a trial with $50. I felt bad about it. I just didn't like it. Like, I only did it because everyone else is like, "Oh, you have to value your work." It's like, I value my work. I just, you know, I don't want to feel like I'm robbing people a little bit. And so, like, so readership was really, really high. And I was just like, you know what, I have these revenue goals for myself every week. This is part of my new project of like not being a weirdo about money. And then I was just like, you know what, I think paywalling is what's going to do it. And like, I love having everything be free. Like, I am committed to use another like annoying academic phrase, like public scholarship.
Yeah.
Like, I taught at BU food studies. I made all my lectures public when I taught culinary tourism. Like, every time I talk at a university or do a talk at like a conference or something, I make it public. Like, it's very important for me to have these things out in open spaces. And so going forward, I'm not going to publish lectures again. That was kind of more of a special thing. Mm-hmm. But like, if I do a talk at a university, like I'm talking at Lafayette or something for Earth Month, I'll publish part of that publicly because I do want that public record in terms of those things. I want to break food studies and academic food studies out of its kind of ivory tower. But at the same time, you know, I need to make a living off of it if it is going to take up all of my time. And like, but again, speaking to like the creator economy as this sort of ride you get on and you never know how you're going to get off it. I also like, I need to create a vision for my life, like that maybe isn't also reliant on this, but in the meantime, I need to make money. So that's really it.
So yeah. In a comment on your On Work in the Internet piece last week, you said, my 2025 plan, once I get my next draft to my book editor, is a whole new thing to launch that can contain my newsletter, but expand greatly what I can do, which smells to me of some kind of publication, larger like editorial magazine vibes. What's going on there?
I really want to... So here, this is an exclusive from me. I really want to launch a literary nonprofit focused on food, focused on academic food studies and food policy things. Sort of, if you remember, there was a website and they did a lot of classes called Catapult that was literary. So I want to focus on food, but have sort of a publication, have a lot of classes, workshops, really sort of, again, just like kind of make space for people who have an interest in these things, but either don't have access or time resources, money resources to dedicate to like a full master's program or that sort of thing. Or, you know, want to kind of you do writing or food writing as a hobby and have a lower barrier to entry to people to find out information about that and how that happens. And sort of like just demystify how all the sausage is made, you know, break apt down the metaphor. Gates, et cetera, an apt metaphor for vegetarian. So yeah, it's, you know, that's kind of my goal in the future and working towards that, because I do need to, I said this on Substack Notes, I do need to create something that isn't tied attached to my name.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got that one written down too.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about like other the waters you're swimming in there, like other publications you admire. I know that you admire Cake Zine. I don't know if you've written for them, but you've promoted them. And you've written in Mold, which I've bought one copy of precisely and is defunct now. I don't know if they're still publishing online, but I know they're not publishing print. And these are both kind of like very forward thinking, progressive. Maybe Atmos is another one, but that's more climate, not food. But these really progressive, exciting kind of avant-garde food publications.
Yeah.
How does this idea that you're fermenting relate to those?
Well, I love both of those. Mold, I love as like an experimental example of what a glossy magazine could do, because it has all of the design and feel, like the look and feel of it is, you know, other than its larger format size, like it feels, you know, like it feels like a W magazine. You know, it's very recognizable in its look and feel, but yet its content is so... it's just so, you know, not coddling the reader. It's really,
there's rigor at every level.
It's really, really pushes people and challenges people in a way that like food writing is sort of, or not supposed to do. But Cake Zine as like a literary journal,
it's kind of the opposite. Sorry to interrupt you. It's kind of like the opposite of the Instagram restaurant guy that you couldn't really call a reviewer, because really what they are is like kind of like a freelance restaurant critic who doesn't criticize. They're freelance, not even critic. They're a freelance restaurant marketer who works for brand deals.
Right, exactly.
There's no rigor.
It's the complete opposite of that, and it's very global in scope, and it's very focused on food from the seed to the plate. So that is why I love Mold, and Cake Zine as a literary journal is doing really great work.
Whetstone,
yes, it's now defunct. Steven was a friend, and Layla is my great friend who is the editorial director there. But yeah, so there's a lot to admire in these publications. And I think that for me, because I've had the experience of like, I was a copier at NY Mag, I worked at Food and Wine, I worked at Edible Brooklyn, and Edible Manhattan. I've been a contributor like to a million different places. Like I've run my own newsletter as a sort of business. Like I've taught at the university level, but I'm also like teaching workshops as like, sort of at a, you know, trying to do it as an affordable scale.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of trying to put all of my stuff together in terms of like thinking of what this could be and also what's missing in the marketplace, let's say.
Yeah.
You know, like something like, you know, Drift is more of a something I'm looking at as an example there. I also really love art. I'm like obsessed with European art magazines like Frieze and Spike. Yeah. And so like I'm looking toward, you know, the publications that are recognizing like crisis in a real way and bringing that into their work and trying to, you know, actually kind of wrestle with things in a real way. And so for me, that's that my idea for a publication that would kind of be the foundation of this idea that I have, it really would, combine the literary food writing, restaurant stuff, humor, all these things that we come to kind of expect and lifestyle stuff. But I want it to be set. I want the writing to be set in the real world and not in the world of luxury. Well,
it's the values, going back to what you'd written. Yeah. It's your values that you said about independence, a strong point of view, humor, rigor, and a reverence towards power, right? It's a publication that represents all those. So in March 2024, a year ago, you wrote an essay called Securing the Brand Bag, which is kind of reading that was how I picked up on you wanting to start a publication. You write, I know that if I were to launch a bigger publication, there would need to be ads in addition to a subscriber base. It's how the economic cookie crumbles. In my fantasy of my future magazine and publishing effort, I have rigorous rules for who fits the standards of a company who can advertise with me. I also know I'm naive. And you kind of start this essay writing about brand trips, and you say, I haven't been on a press trip since 2019, and I don't see myself doing them again without a lot of different conditions being met. And I was curious what those conditions could be.
So the funny thing is, the last brand trip I went on, 2019, to Cognac, France, fantastic. I used to write about cocktails a lot, and so like that was why I was there. I ended up getting food poisoning at the end of it, and the essay I ended up writing about this brand trip was about throwing up. So,
That's
it was called Of Cognac and Vomit, and it ended up being a notable essay in Best American Travel Writing that year. So, I was notable in Best American Travel Writing, but then for a long time, I never got invited again on a trip.
You wrote a piece too good for them.
It was just too rigorous about my puking. Anyway, but also that goes back to mold, like that's a magazine that'll write about waste and the uglier sides of things. Anyway, but the conditions of the press trip thing for me are just that I would be able to write what I wanted to write and not. But the thing is that press trips make you just feel bullied. And now, frankly, they don't need me. They just have influencers and they fly them. They treat them much nicer from what I've
tell. This is something one of my pet ideas that I haven't fully solidified is the difference between a creator and an influencer. And I don't know that there is one, but it's the goal of this project to make those differences. And my theory, or how I've positioned it, is like there isn't really so much thing as an influencer anymore. Everyone has had to become a content creator, because to me the content creator side is more about the craft. You can't just post the expertly posed Instagram photo anymore and call it a day. Maybe a few people, but influencing is more of like yet another revenue stream available to the content creator. And what it is to act as a freelance marketer, where besides any skill you have in copywriting and photography, it's your inbuilt audience that you're also selling. So do you agree? Like that's what, like, influencing is a thing a creator can do, and that's what it is.
This is really interesting, and I like this, and it reminds me of a TikTok that I saw yesterday where someone was talking about authenticity creators versus like ad-based creators.
Okay.
And it was interesting analysis of this. I like to see the armchair analysis on TikTok. And like, so she was saying that the people that get follows, and I would think of like, it's someone like Benton McClintock, who I don't know if you know his videos on TikTok. So he's someone who you like and follow his videos because he's really, really funny, and he's a very unique point of view. And because he doesn't come from money, he like is actually talking about real things a lot of the time. He has like a character who like is talking about the water wars of like the year 2070 or something. So he's funny. And he'll do ads sometimes, but he's one of these creators that falls into the box of people don't watch and support and like and comment on his videos if they're ads. And then that makes it harder for him to make a living versus someone like, I don't know. I mean, Alex Earle might skirt.
You wrote a good piece about this. One of the ones I read last night, where it's like there are these some people who, when they post, like you were talking about somebody who works with the brand that does the Quadratini wafer cookies, and how like she did an ad and it worked perfectly with what she does and her audience. And people were supporting like, I love this ad in the comments because that's the kind of audience and relationship with her audience she's built.
Right. Justine Dwaron, who's a food creator, the recipe developer. She put out a cookbook. Again, it does speak to how difficult it is to decide what someone is anymore when our work is online. But I think that there is this barrier that happens when you're, and I think it would happen for me, you know, if I just all of a sudden published an ad in my newsletter for something, it would be very strange.
Because you're so critical and you're like, you write so much about like questioning these things and the questioning power, et cetera.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that, I mean, frankly, like I would rather not go down that road because I think it's just one other road that's tons and tons of work to go nowhere and also might collapse at any moment.
You've done so much work that allows you to do the more rigorous like magazine experiment. And you kind of, again, you're not a creator, you're a writer, and you've like constantly made decisions against that. We've kind of moved on already from your newsletter and the details of the business, but I did want to ask about the weekly salons and which it's kind of a thing for your paid subscribers every Monday at 3 p.m. EST, live chat, a hangout, a space to build camaraderie, as you write. What's the culture there? What's the community? Who are the people in your audience and how do they relate to you and to each other?
Well, it's a lot of other writers. It's a lot of academics. It's a lot of, you know, researchers, lots of people who are kind of in this, touching the same fields that I write about or work in.
Would you say that most of the people who pay for your newsletter are these people who are also kind of in this industry and are paying because they want the critical thinking about this industry being like food media, basically?
I don't think it's necessarily food media people are like the higher echelon of like who people think of when they think of as food writers. It's definitely people who, you know, I have journalists, but like physics journalists and lots of people in PhD programs, lots of bakers who use alternative grains. Like it's a very specific niche that I occupy. Someone researches wildfires. You know, I have a very specific audience of people who are interested in food, but they're also interested in climate change and ecology and food, like food systems.
Well, you're like a systems writer almost more than you're a food writer. And that's how you're able to write so well about digital media and online work and the creator economy as well. Like you are really good at understanding and making understandable systems.
Oh, thank you.
Well, actually, I want to move on to another question, but I want to hear more about the weekly salons first.
Well, no, we kind of come in and we say, I'm like, basically, hey guys, what's going on? Like, here's what I'm working on, or I read this article, what do you guys think? And I ask everyone, like, you know, what are you reading or watching or working on? And so people can kind of share, they can also share resources, people share their, you know, their cooking inspiration. This Monday, someone made a whole meal because they were inspired by the conversation in the salon. Like, so that inspired what they made for dinner. Last week, someone picked up a book in their local free library because someone else had mentioned it in the salon. So it's like, it's something where like it really does influence people's like material, like tactile lives away from social media. And so that's kind of what I wanted it to be, is a way for, because I do think that like, depending on where you live and what your life is like on a day-to-day basis, you might be someone who's really into literature and food and thinking about, you know, all these issues, but you might not have people around you in your day-to-day life to talk about those things with. And so for me, that's why I did the salons and I do the book club, because it's just a way to kind of make space, you know, because it might not be every week you come on and have the chat, but it might be a week where, you know, you kind of feel like you need someone to talk
to. Like your neighborhood bar or something.
Exactly. Yeah. Like you come be a regular at the bar and have a drink on Monday afternoon. And so that's kind of the space I wanted to create and to put folks in conversation, because I was realizing how much my readers had in common. And I was like, I need to figure out a way to put folks in contact more. And also the book club was a way for me to the salons, the book club, these are ways for me to like use my newsletter to develop and further things that I'm interested in, rather than like, I used to develop recipes a lot and I like developing recipes, but when you have to develop a recipe like every week or every other week, it becomes a different beast. And so these are ways that like actually give energy back to me, because I'm actually talking to people. We're like really like getting into it. So yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So there's over 40,000 people in the audience. I'm curious where they've come from, and what I kind of expect, my impression is that you were early on Substack. So you've kind of like ridden like with any platform that is, you know, so discovery based, you've ridden that wave of being on there and being a quality presence for years. So people have gone to you, you get bigger, more people come. And now you're kind of at the point where you're like, maybe you're leaving. I've seen you talking a bit about that, but then it represents a big financial investment.
Yeah.
Kind of getting ahead of the skis here. But has it just been like kind of that early platform surfing growth?
Well, no, I think for me, it was that I was on Twitter and really active on Twitter.
Yeah.
So from 20, like for a million years before 2020, I was really active on Twitter.
You scoured it. I couldn't find a trace.
Oh, good. Thank you. Yeah. Thank gosh. So I was, and that also like the only thing I'll thank Elon for is making such a disaster that no one can find any of my tweets.
Yeah.
So I was not huge. I left Twitter with 30,000 followers, but I was, you know, I was just a consistent tweeter.
And that meant more then.
Yeah. And I was in that like journalist like vibe, food writing vibe. I was like, you know, it was like the water cooler for you and your colleagues, blah, blah, blah. So when I started publishing the newsletter, I would share it there. And so I think I had a lot of growth from that. But my newsletter has grown very, very steadily. One thing I don't like about Substack is the growth padding that kind of happens when you're on the app. Like, I don't really like the recommend. If I could opt out of recommendations, I would. Like, I do think if I were growing solely organically, I would probably still be at 25,000 free subscribers.
That's crazy, actually, that you can't opt out.
Yeah, I don't. Maybe you can, but I try not to get too in the weeds on settings and stuff. But you know, I have, and I know this because, like, or not, I know this, but like, I have 25,000 hyper engaged readers. Like, those are the people, and those are the people I want to capture.
Does that
more
mean they
of.
Open like three issues a month or what?
Or they open within 24 hours.
Oh, okay.
So it's yeah. So that, like, for me is though that's the base, and then everything beyond that is sort of extra. Obviously,
so your open rate is like. Very high. No, we don't have to get into the detailed statistics, but yeah.
Well, right now I'm taking a break from looking at my – I'm like taking a Q1 break from looking at stats because just for my mental health.
And you're working on the book. And, yeah.
Yeah, I have the – I'm in the book edits. I'm like, I just – you know what? I'm going to – I'm very – like I've had to try and have a lot of like mindfulness practices.
Yeah, let's move on. I don't want to –
No. But I like – those are the people that I want to capture by having a paywall. Like, I'm like, if you open this every single week and I'm not getting more of you on board to pay for it – and I understand that, like, people don't want more stuff in their inbox or whatever it is. And I do send out, like, an extra email every week to the paid subscribers. But, like, it's really a low lift, you know. Yeah. And so I want to just capture more of those folks. Like, my goal is to get to 3,000 paid subscribers for sure.
Nice. Good goal.
But I'm at, like, 2,200.
That's still really good.
Yeah.
I do want to move on to that systems conversation I was alluding to earlier. So again, this is a quote from your March 2024 Securing the Brand Bag essay. You say, "I don't want to rain on anyone's parade. It's hard to make a living out here, and more people deserve to do so in order to tell new stories, give new recipes, provide fresh inspiration. But I want to ask questions about what is really happening when brands are in charge of the money and thus the narrative. What food media are we building? Could we be doing it better?" So that kind of last line reminded me of one of my pet definitions of creator, which is one of the more like kind of abstracted and less useful ones, but it's just somebody who contributes to the corpus of the internet, which like reading that made me think of, you know, how agriculture and like food businesses contributes to literally the corpus of the world and its people and individual people. Right. So I was wondering if you had any more like analogies for creator economy, digital media ecosystem, whatever, that come from the food world. I think an obvious one is like food co-ops, co-op models, and cooperatively owned media businesses like Your Defector, Hearing Things, et cetera. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's a fertile ground for an analogy there.
Absolutely. And to sort of decentralize the production of the stuff. And this for me is sort of what I would like to do with a new food. But obviously I'm sort of in beginning stages of thinking about it, but I would really like it to be sort of an ecosystem where there's also people, which sounds like Medium, but it's not, but like where people who are already selected could use it as their outlet as well. Mm-hmm. And so it's a bit more, it's less hierarchical. It's more horizontal in terms of who's able to have access to the audience. And access, obviously, then to the funding and the money. And so that's sort of what I have been thinking about. But for me, yeah, like it's just interesting to me this model we've built without a lot of questioning. where, you know, obviously, like, you know, you Anna Wintour and what she decides is goes into an editorial is going to be influenced by who spent the most ad money. Like, yeah. We know this. We know how that works. But at the same time, the brand isn't going to be at the photo shoot. The brand isn't going to decide which model is wearing it. The brand, like, there's a lot of things that have been just given up in the influencer economy, the creator economy. A lot of control has been given up in order to secure the bag, in order to get the brand deal and get the money and to be amenable and to be, you know, it's very different when you are, I don't know, when you're like a talent who is really, really valued for your talent and not for your broad appeal. It's just a different beast, you know, like, and that's why I think I do hold on to being a writer more than anything, because I don't want anything to be dependent on, you know, what I look like, first of all. And I don't want it to be dependent on how appealing I can be to a broad swath of people. Like, I mean, I have a pop for a person like a vegetarian, you know, eco-socialist, I have a popular newsletter, but like, you know, I just find that a really, really bad space.
Well, let me give you a quote from another one of your essays, which is the when you wrote this month on the politics of attention in 2025. Yeah. You say, the more people look to individuals, even well-compensated individuals with management teams, the more reliant internet culture is on learning from or being entertained by content creators whose faces are the key to their work, the more the audience is asking people to exhaust and exploit themselves.
Yeah. And I say that even about people who are doing really, really well. Like, there is no end to the demand. And that's what really terrifies me. And there is no demand to how appealing people have to be. And there is no end to, like, the possibility that you'll lose it all because of, like, you know, I don't know. It's just such a precarious situation that has been created. And it's been for the gain of, I mean, Amazon. Everybody has an Amazon storefront. It's been great for Amazon. It's been great for fast fashion. It's been great for Zara. Like, it's been great. This hyper production cycle has created a hyper consumption cycle that no one really understands how to break out of. And, you know, that's the thing that scares me about it, is that we're not really focusing anymore on developing people who have really, really, really good skills in one thing. We're developing people who are really good at moving to the whims of the masses and brands. Like, two things that people who are creating what we are thinking about as culture, that's not really a great thing, you know?
It's like, race to the bottom.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I don't know, there's like a line in there, I guess, too, about like the commodification of information and like factory farming. And again, going back to the corpus and like, you are what you eat and you are the information you consume. And going back to the beginning of our conversation about like decentralizing meaning and like losing media literacy and like that being the point. Now I'm starting to get a little tin hatty here. I want to talk about your relationship with platforms. So one more quote. You say the newsletter form has, in that same essay, the newsletter form has been successful across demographics because it gives a quiet space somewhere between social media and print. It provides an outlet for an intimate reply, not publicly shared and potentially driving unwanted attention. So I don't want to get, we've talked a little bit about platforms already, and I don't want to get like so deep into it.
Yeah.
But you used to be really active on Twitter. You're not there anymore. You are quite active on Substack Notes. And again, you've talked about getting away. Like, what is your dream? Like, you are somebody who is good at using platforms to your advantage, and like not being subsumed by them. But what is like your dream relationship to platforms?
Oof. I don't know. I think I would. Why is that such a big question? I mean, that speaks to like the psychological, like the imaginative hole that platforms have on one who spends a lot of time online. That it's very difficult to kind of disentangle, like imagining disentangling myself, like from say Substack is very difficult because it has been the source of my livelihood since 2020. But at the same time, I can kind of also, because I've been there since 2020, I can see what they're doing, which is like way more focused on the app and on owning the following lists and people can't upgrade on the app for whatever Apple reasons, but there's so many things that they just decided to collect everybody in this hog pen.
Let me read. Actually, I'm reminded with Daisy on our other podcast, Tasteland. We interviewed Mike Pepe a few weeks ago, who just had his book Against Platforms come out. And I'm kind of realizing as I ask you that question, it's like, well, what is a platform?
Right.
And it's kind of a question he tries to answer. And I'm going to read some. I wrote these in my notes for that podcast. A few kind of explicit and implicit definitions. Let's see. Platforms are defined less by their cultural characteristics and more by what they enable. Platforms, the capitalist remains of failed digital utopias, private for-profit platforms where labor is content, citizens are users swathed in data, and difference, nuance, and focus is something that instant and constant connectivity must blast away. Networked, globalized, and constantly surveilled data exchanges. Innovation that intervened not just through the engineering of computer science, but into the social and the political fabric upon which goods and services are exchanged. That innovation was the platform. And finally, the primary feature of the platform is that it enables users to enact or participate in some activity without authorities. So it's grab bag for you.
And, No, I mean, that's an interesting, I need to read that book now because I'm really interested in that. I mean, for me, when I think of a platform, I guess it's like a two-prong meaning. It's the tool that you're using is the platform of whatever you're using it for. But also then people talk about like having a platform. So it's like how many followers, how many subscribers, whatever that is. And that any sort of responsibility that one might believe,
which
comes
is that
with
content
that.
Capital idea.
Exactly. The content capital
writes about. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that in terms of, I would really like to take my subscribers somewhere where I have a little bit more control over the situation, because for me, and I'm in a privileged position for this because I know that a lot of people who are just starting out or have smaller lists, they need that growth. At this point for me, I don't need it and I don't necessarily want, like for me, I want conversions and I don't necessarily need to keep growing my free base. Of course, the thing is, of course, the free base would like significantly dwindle if I left Substack because I wouldn't have this constantly like self-replenishing.
And people still unsubscribe.
Exactly. Every time you send, every week you send it and they unsubscribe. So like that churn is part of it. But like I really would rather focus on a smaller set of people than to have kind of, I don't know, people who don't really, you know, for example, like
you
the chat. I don't want scale. Like, and for my like chat, I never let people reply to anything. And it's because a lot of the time they haven't read me. They don't really know what I'm about. And it's just the engagement is such of a caliber that is just not worthwhile. Like, and I know that
not
sounds kind
caliber.
Of mean.
Yeah.
It sounds mean, but at the same time, it's just like, I've cut off all channels for people other than knowing
my
email.
It's not mean. This goes back to the social the positive social friction that we were talking about like almost an hour ago now.
Yeah. And I don't want I just don't want negativity. I don't like, I know from being on Twitter for so long, like how much my own mental health will be degraded by like some nonsense, like getting myself into a nonsense conversation. Yeah. Like I just want to avoid that. And like, that's made it me able to do a lot more work and I would rather be doing work.
So speaking of doing work, you have a year ago, you announced that your upcoming book on eating, there's that on.
I never know what it's going to actually be the title. You know,
yeah, because that was just in the marketplace.
Yeah.
So you sold it. But you're in the edit phase right now. And in a recent issue of the newsletter, you wrote something I liked. Personally, I've never written anything longer than like 10,000 words, like a college paper. But I write, 1,200 words or whatever every week for the newsletter. But you say that the book is a space where I'm able to play at a grander scale than essays allow. And after the experience of writing my first book being a crash course in how to sustain a thought over tens of thousands of words, this time around, I'm more interested in structure and what kind of experience I want to construct for the reader. So kind of probably the last question here, but I would love for you to speak more about that and like the experience of writing the book as opposed to the kind of constant grind of writing the newsletter.
Well, the writing a book is just such a different beast. And because my first book was, a cultural history of plant-based food in the last like 50 years of the US. So it was very like straightforward. The way I wrote it hopefully wasn't very straightforward or dry, but it was just very straightforward in what the story that I had to tell and the kind of the what had to be done. Like, the work was really in that sort of like making a point in a way that doesn't, I don't know, fold in on itself over and over again. And so writing this book, which is more of a memoir, so it's a lot more focused on me, but it's sort of like it's kind of a balance of memoir and more of the systems writing that you were mentioning, but through different ingredients. So it's a memoir through ingredients and the ways in which those ingredients come to us in history. And so it was more, for me, it's more about how do I do a balance between those things and not go too far in either direction. So, you know, to just keep the reader absorbed, but not feel like I'm being self-absorbed, let's say. But also, you know, my editor, who was fantastic at Heche, Renee, she was like, people are going to want more of the personal. So like my natural inclination is to like kind of sprinkle myself in. Yeah. And so my project with this was kind of finding more balance in how to make myself the subject while also actually giving the reader what I actually like more naturally write about, which is like, yeah. Apples and mythology and stuff.
Have you read, as an aside, have you read the book I'm currently reading is Hanif Abdurraqib's There's Always This Year?
I know I need to read it, but I didn't want to read it while I was writing.
No, because then you absorb too much of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really, but when you talk about like structure and stuff, I've never read a book with this specific structure. Anyways, he's a great writer.
Yes.
But this is about you. I think we could end it there though. Check out the book when it comes out. Where should people go to find the newsletter?
AliciaKennedy.news.
Perfect. Go find it. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you.